Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today, very special guest, Gordon Chang is with us, who I met recently at the Casey Research Summit, and he gave a really inspired talk there, really caught my attention, and I wanted to make sure we could get him for a podcast. We have him today. He is the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, released by Random House in January of 2006. Showdown focusing on the nuclear proliferation in general, but North Korean crisis in particular. His first book is The Coming Collapse of China, Random House, came out in August of 2001. He's a columnist at Forbes.com, and I'm going to be talking about one of those columns that just came out recently. He's lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for almost two decades, recently in Shanghai as counsel to the American law firm of Paul Weiss, earlier also in Hong Kong as partner in the international law firm of Baker & McKenzie. His writings on China and North Korea have appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Far East Economic Review, International Herald Tribune, many other places. Welcome, Gordon.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you here. And so for our listeners, I gave some of your background, but can you just fill us in briefly about your experience and background in China, how often you actually get to visit there to see for yourself how things are unfolding and any other context that might be helpful here?
Yeah, I worked in Hong Kong for about 10 years in the 1980s. And then I worked in Shanghai from 1996 to 2001. And between those two times, I traveled back and forth to China. And since that time, I go back once or twice a year. We just returned a couple weeks ago from Hong Kong, where there's a lot of news about the Chinese economy, largely because it's starting to turn and people are worried about what's going to happen, not only to what's going to happen in the mainland, but what's going to happen in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong's economy right now is very tied to China's.
Sure. You know, China's clearly roared into the world economic stage as a major player over these past 10 years, certainly. And a lot of my listeners are really keenly interested in China because China is now shaping the economic landscape as never before. So we have questions, you know, big ones, like such as for how much longer will China continue to fund U.S. and European indebtedness? And will China's voracious appetite for world resources lead to friction as we compete in a world of increasing per capita scarcity? In your words, tell us why we should be tracking over here in the OECD countries, why we should be tracking China closely.
Well, China's economy clearly is influential. It's the second largest in the world, surpassing Japan in the second quarter of last year. Many people think that it will overtake ours. Time magazine recently ran a piece suggesting that would take 9 years, and the IMF says 5 years. Now, I don't believe any of that, but nonetheless, that is the global dominant narrative. And right now, you know, China seems to be on a tear, but we are starting, of course, to see the signs of the Chinese economy slow, and slow in a way that we haven't seen for a decade. And that's why, for instance, people in Hong Kong are concerned, and we are starting to see the signs of deterioration.
Well, it's interesting. You know, in one very important way, China already has overtaken the United States, and that's in energy consumption. I think they did that in 2010. On a total terawatt basis. And so, of course, energy is the driving motive force for any economy. So seeing China growing its energy use by 7% per year, they doubled it in only a decade. That story, you're saying, is slowing down. We saw GDP slow from, I guess it was 9.7, and now it's 9.2. Maybe it's going to slip into the eights. That still sounds like really aggressive growth to me. Does that look like a soft landing? Is that what's going on? Or are you saying that there's worry now in Hong Kong that maybe something harder is coming?
I think something harder is coming. In the third quarter of this year, the National Bureau of Statistics in Beijing said growth was 9.1%. That's a year-on-year figure. But if you start to look at month-on-month numbers, it is of concern. So you talked about electricity consumption. August to July, electricity consumption slipped 0.1%. September to August, it increased by 3.1%. That looks like an economy which is growing at a pretty low rate, if it's growing at all. And there are other indicators showing that the economy is actually slipping. So, for instance, oil demand, export orders, car sales. In October, last month, car sales declined 4.2% year on year. So we're starting to see the signs of the economy flatline. And I think that's the big story. Month on month, this economy is flatlining.
Okay, well, yeah, sometimes there's a little noise in that monthly data, but you're saying we've seen a couple of sustained months here. Certainly, when we look across the rest of the global landscape, we're seeing a lot of signs of slowing down from manufacturing, orders, trade, all kinds of things. China sitting at the center of a lot of trade. So if their economy does flatline, what's the risk you see?
Well, the risk is certainly for the political system in China. There is a number of countries where, you know, where you have authoritarianism, you have large growth numbers year after year after year, and all of a sudden the economy contracts and the political system falls apart. The most recent was, of course, well, not the most recent, but perhaps the most important example for China was Indonesia under Suharto. And, of course, economic reasons were part of the triggers for the Arab Spring. Youth unemployment, high inflation, those things that we see in China as well. So clearly Chinese leaders are concerned about what's going on in the Middle East and North Africa, largely because they have some of the same economic problems that they saw over there.
You know, I just an article in the Financial Times November 4th really caught my eye, and I was hoping to get your take on it. It's entitled China's Elite Have New International Outlook. And they note for most of the article that there's been an exodus of wealth and the wealthy to safer shores. But we found these closing paragraphs, which I'd like to read out and get your take on them, because these really made my eyebrows jump. In private conversations, the article says, many of the people who supposedly make up the ruling elite of China express serious misgivings about the direction and future stability of the country, while admitting that they feel largely powerless to affect meaningful change. There is a sense that we are approaching an inevitable breaking point when the pressures in society will boil over and consume the rulers, says one Chinese banker with close ties to a number of powerful political families. He continues, almost all of the elements are in place for an uprising like we saw in 1989. Corruption is worse today than it was then. People feel they can't get ahead without political connections. The wealth gap is much bigger and growing, and there's been virtually no political reform at all. The only missing ingredient now is a domestic economic crisis. What's your take? Those are pretty strong words, I thought, and expressing a serious sentiment. Is this hyperbole, or how do you interpret those words?
There's a growing sense, a growing concern in China about all of those things that you just read about, largely because the political system has got to a point where, first of all, it's in a transition. Starting at the end of next year, the Communist Party is going to change the officers of the Politburo Standing Committee, the apex of political power in China. We're going to have a new general party secretary. And then in the early part of 2013, the government officers change. And sometime after that, the all-important Central Military Commission has a revamp of membership. And so at this time of political transition, the important economic decisions are not being made. But it's even worse than that, because corruption indeed is engulfing the political system. It's causing so much friction in society. The Communist Party is not able to mediate conflict, and its only answer is to increase coercion. And that's why you have survey after survey of the rich and the super rich. They talk about leaving China. It's not the poor who are going, which we've seen in many waves throughout the last couple hundred years. Now the rich are thinking of getting out. They're getting passports. They're putting their families offshore. And this is a concern because this is a leading indicator. If you go about 25 miles south of where I live, I go to Princeton, New Jersey, you'll see a lot of beautiful homes. I mean, they're all paid for. They've got a wife there. They've got kids, one or two Mercedes in the driveway. It's the perfect American family, except one thing is missing, and that's Dad. Dad is a senior official in Beijing, and he's stealing as much money as he can. And at maybe not the first sign of trouble, but perhaps the second sign of trouble, he's on the United flight to New York because he's not going to stay to defend a regime that is shaky. And that's one of the reasons why I think we have to be concerned about the way the Chinese economy is going, because Chinese rich are starting to see the signs and are beginning to bail out.
Well, that's I think, isn't that always sort of true in any country where you have the wealthy try and find a way to spread their wealth? That's part of that could be diversification. But you're saying this is really against a backdrop of understanding that China does go through periodic convulsions, as it were, and that this is maybe the most well-connected people with the best insights, those are the ones who are choosing to exercise their options, as it were?
Yes, and it's also the people with the most to lose by leaving. So we're not talking about, you know, some laborer in some inland province who gets a chance to go to Europe or the United States. We're talking about the people who have benefited the most from this system, and they can see the problems at the top of society. We have now a weak General Party Secretary, Hu Jintao, and he's going to be followed by probably someone who is just as weak, especially in his beginning years, Xi Jinping. This is a political system that will not be able to make the decisions and to implement them that everybody needs, that everyone knows have to be made. And that's why, for instance, we have not seen much in the way of reform over the last 5 years. In fact, we've seen a reversal of reform. And most of the conditions that have given rise to China's extraordinary growth either no longer exist or are disappearing fast. And so this is an economy in trouble.
You know, Gordon, I had written a while ago that I thought when I put on one lens and I look at the world and I say, wow, I see increasing scarcity of critical resources, land for growing food, water, oil, things like that. It appeared to me like China was pursuing what I thought was a very credible strategy of mercantilist policy, go out, magic checkbook, and buying stuff everywhere, you know, land in Madagascar and oil from wherever it could get it, et cetera. And those felt to me like an advantage, as it were, of the Chinese system, where they could develop a state policy around getting resources at a critical moment of history, and they could go and execute that, which seemed to me to have potentially some advantages over waiting for your quote-unquote free market system to arrive at the same conclusion and to secure things through normal competitive practices. Would you agree that China's been on a fairly strategic platform of securing resources? And if so, are you saying that strategy is now at risk because of this transitionary phase?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, Chinese leaders have been very determined in their strategic goals of securing commodities. But, and this is a big but, overpaying for oil and gas and copper and all the rest of it doesn't really make sense in the long run. These guys in Beijing don't believe in spot markets, and because of that, they will sometimes just commit too much in the way of resources. And now that they've got an economy that needs less oil, needs less copper, needs less iron ore, they're in trouble. So they've stockpiled this stuff. It looks nice, but I don't think that the world has gotten to a point where the spot markets are going to disappear, which means that China has probably made some pretty bad investments. Yes, it's strategic, but it might have been the wrong strategic decision to make.
So they've overpaid, and we come into a period of weakness, and they have fairly long-term contracts where they're locked in. I see they have a gas contract with Iran that's, 25 years or something, copper contract, same thing. So oil too. So you're saying they've overpaid and that this will be a weakness as we go into this period of lower growth?
Yeah, I think that it will be a burden. If we're talking about a world where scarcity is really the dominant issue, then yes, it's great to have even overpaid for this stuff. But if we're talking about a world where it maybe needs less of these commodities and where they're plentiful and where prices are declining, then yeah, I don't think that was so smart.
Well, the one area that seems tight to me is food. Simply, we crossed 7 billion, apparently, and land is one thing that we've pretty much got all of it under cultivation. So food is one area where I know everything that I've read says China has some real serious issues. They've depleted a couple of key aquifers, drawn them down really far. They've had some desertification issues with some of their key land for agriculture. Do you see the food issues in China as being a pressure point for them here?
Eventually it will be, largely because they've polluted a lot of their land, and also because they don't price water correctly, there is a great incentive to use it inefficiently. Mm. You started out by talking about China becoming the world's largest consumer of energy, and yes, that's right. But the point is that they put in five times the amount of energy per unit of gross domestic product than Japan. These are staggering numbers because they just misprice it. Whenever you misprice things, yes, you can do a lot in terms of creating economic growth, and the Chinese leaders have been pretty good at that up to now. But inefficiency eventually catches up with every economy. They've got a semi-closed system so that they're not necessarily subject to the principles of economics in the same way that we are, but they can only delay the inevitable. They can't prevent it entirely. And that's really going to be their problem, because they have done a lot which just doesn't make economic sense. I mean, it might make sense in terms of rapid buildup of an economy, but they've got to pay a price, and they haven't paid their price yet. The one thing that people say, you know, oh, these Chinese leaders are so great at economic management because they got through 2008, 2009, and they had enormous double-digit growth while the rest of us were suffering. Well, yes, they did that, but they did that at great cost. So, for instance, in 2009, the first full year of their stimulus plan, they dumped something like $1.1 trillion into a then $4.3 trillion economy. So did they create growth? Yes, they did. But they also created a stock market bubble, a property market bubble, and inflation. And they have yet to deal with the property market and the inflation problems. Those are dislocations that they don't have answers to. I would rather have our economic problems than theirs any day of the week.
Interesting. You know, I see that the Shanghai Composite Index is down 20% on the year, putting it in bear market territory for the year. And if we stretch back 5 years, we note that it's down 58% from its 2007 peak. So even with that 25% boost to GDP with the stimulus package you just mentioned, it doesn't really seem to have recovered the stock market all that much. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because in 2009, the Shanghai Composite increased I think 80.0% because of the stimulus. The government put much too much money into the economy, more money than it could absorb, so it went into non-productive uses, which was the stock market rise and the property market bubble. And what's happened in 2010 was the inevitable, that the stock market collapsed. And even after a bad 2010, 2011 doesn't look too good either. So essentially what they did was they engineered growth at great cost. And so, yes, the Chinese stock market doesn't really say very much about the way of economic management in Beijing.
Right. Well, you know, every bubble is always looking for a pin. And we noted before that this unnamed high-level banker had said that the only missing ingredient now is a domestic economic crisis. I want to turn now to one likely place, which would be the property market. It's something I've followed pretty closely for a while, and I'd love to get your take on this. And luckily, you have this recent Forbes article entitled Property Prices Collapse in China. Is this a crash? And you note that what started as a softening of prices in September has turned into a rout in October, with at least one builder, you noted, cutting its asking prices to the cost of development. So as with any property bubble, first you get oversupply, then softening sales volumes, then stagnant prices, then ever sort of increasingly declining prices. You seem to be implying here we're at that final stage of that progression. Help us understand this a little better, could you?
Yeah. What happened with the stock market happened with the property market. There was just too much money in the economy, so people then poured money into apartments. And China has gone on a tear building ghost cities and all the rest of it. And the progression that you talked about, which was skyrocketing prices and then stable prices, slowing volume, and then property price declines, is what we're seeing in China. In October, last month, prices in places like Shanghai declined 30% as we saw developers start to offer these enormous discounts. And by the way, these discounts were so big that people who bought at earlier stages of the same developments where these discounts were being offered have now taken to the streets complaining, if you're giving 30% discounts to these other guys, then give it to me as well. And so we've now got a little bit of social unrest because of falling property prices. In Wenzhou, which is in prosperous Zhejiang province, which was perhaps the most prosperous province up till about a year ago, one developer is now offering BMWs to the first 150 buyers of apartments. And this is just a sign that property prices have not only softened, but they are starting to fall quickly. You know, every market has to go to equilibrium. There's too many apartments in China, and not enough buyers and occupiers, and it was going to go to equilibrium in some fashion. What is really surprising observers is that the rapidity at which we see this move to equilibrium. Last year, there were in about, I guess it was April or May, the state grid in China reported that there were 64.5 million apartments that showed no electricity usage for six consecutive months. That's enough housing for 200 million people. But yet Beijing was decreeing the building of 30 to 50 million more apartment units. You know, this is creates GDP, technically GDP,
yeah.
But at the end of the day, there's got to be a correction. And what goes up fast comes down fast. And what we're seeing is the down phase. The only issue is whether Beijing can stop the down phase by administrative measures. But so far, the Chinese leaders, Premier Wen Jiabao last Sunday said, nope, we're going to stay with these tightening measures. And that has really created great pessimism in the Chinese property market.
You know, one of the things that I tracked carefully in our own housing bubble here in the U.S. was really everything, I think, can be tracked price to income. As you mentioned, all markets have to go to equilibrium. A normal market here in the U.S. is a price to income of around 3 to 4. By the time you get over 5 or even 6, prices are now 6 times income in a region. You got a bubble on your hands. And there were some shocking numbers that came out as high as 9 in Orange County, as high as 12 in some places in around Las Vegas. So these were really shocking numbers. And so I cast my attention over to China, and I'd read reports that had suggested that in certain key metropolitan areas, the price to income had gone over 20. Is that true?
I think that is true. The last time that we went to Shenzhen, which is just across the border from Hong Kong, we talked to a number of people who were saying that they could not afford apartments. And although they wanted to stay in Shenzhen, they just couldn't really afford it. And so what they were thinking was moving back to their home villages in the inland part of China, where price levels were much more affordable. And that really is a political issue. And that's why Beijing is not backing off of its property tightening measures, because it wants to make housing affordable for China's growing middle class, and even perhaps for the poor. So really what we have is a government now that is really trying to bring the property market down. And of course it wants to do so gradually, orderly. But as you say, it's a bubble, there's a pin, and the problem is that the Chinese leaders cannot manage the process of bringing the property market down to equilibrium.
So how does the property market work in China? I'm a private Chinese citizen, a laborer somewhere, and I want to buy an apartment. How does that work?
Well, it works pretty much the same as anywhere else. The only differences are going to be that there are administrative measures that increase the down payments, prevent you from buying maybe a second home, all sorts of things that will make it more difficult on your second purchase. But on your first purchase, it's pretty much the same as anywhere else. What's happened is that the wealthy in China have seen apartments as a store of value, because bank deposits pay negative interest, because the stock market's a disaster. People have seen apartments as really the store of value. It's instead of currency, it's apartments in Beijing. And that's why you had so many apartments not showing electricity consumption, because these weren't really places for people to live in. These were just basically, here's my cash, I want to keep it in property. And the problem right now is that you're seeing this unwind. So people who thought that they were wealthy a month and a half ago now realize that they're at risk, because they can't sell these things. They're competing against developers who are slashing 30% off the price last month. When China's elite analysts start talking about prices being 50% of where they are this year, that means that they're probably privately thinking that no, prices won't halve. They might, go down even further than that. And that's really a problem, because that mentality, once it gets embedded in people's minds in China, really means that Chinese leaders then have very few tools in which to prop up the property market.
Well, this is, I just want to make sure I'm really clear on this. So when somebody goes and gets a mortgage, is that from a private bank or a state bank?
Most likely it's going to be a state bank, because the state banks dominate the banking system. And so you have the four large state banks, and then you have a lot of other large state banks below that. There are a few banks that are in private hands, but they're pretty few and far between. These state banks do have some private ownership because they've issued stock in these massive IPOs, but the state still controls them. And that's why people call them the state banks, even though they have issued shares in offerings.
Okay, so my back-of-the-envelope calculations, when I look at, a price-to-income ratio that's over 20, you can easily arrive at a 70 to 80% fall in house prices. With overshoot, you could make an argument for more. That's just to get back to a market clearing price. It doesn't matter to me what the development cost was, because the developer probably overpaid for labor, land, materials, everything. The market clearing price is what people can afford to buy. And once the psychology of bubble bursting takes hold, it takes time. Even if the prices ran up really fast, it still takes time for these things to clear out, sometimes years. So we might be looking at a sort of a multi-year protracted sort of a slump in the hotter markets. And so what happens then? State Bank is sitting on a pile of bad mortgages. What happens in the Chinese system when somebody, A, can't pay a mortgage? Is it a normal default process, or is there recourse attached to that loan in some way? And if these state banks start going bad, how do they get bailed out?
Well, state banks, because of China's terrible court system, you know, the banks don't really have that much recourse against defaulting borrowers. So essentially, the government in Beijing is just not going to want to see banks foreclosing on a lot of this stuff. So I don't see that really happening. What it means essentially, though, is that Beijing has got to bail out the state banks. They've done that before. They did that at the end of the 1990s, and they did that to a lesser extent about 5 years ago. The state banks are actually critical to the economy, so they are the last institutions to fail. The problem for China, though, is that the bailout 10 years ago, they still haven't cleared out those bad loans out of the system. Because what they did was the finance ministry indirectly bought those bad loans from the banks. But those bad loans now are on the books of the finance ministry, hidden from view. And they haven't sold those off yet because China's leaders really were loath to take losses. If we want to see what their mentality is, the best thing to do is look at the way the Japanese handled their bubble instead of recognizing their losses and getting on with it like we did with the Resolution Trust Company and the savings and loans. They've decided to try to manage their way out of this softly. And so Japan had, you know, recession-like stagnation. China, best scenario is that they look like Japan, you know, an ailing economy. Probably in China, though, it's going to be worse because the Japanese people were living in a democracy. The Chinese people are not, and we have seen the reactions of Chinese people whenever there's been problems in the markets. So this doesn't look good for the Communist Party. That's why they're very nervous in Beijing. That's why they're spending more on domestic security than they are on the People's Liberation Army. They know that they've got a real problem, and they don't know how to get themselves out of it.
It's an interesting observation that when the leadership thinks there's social unrest coming, that you can track their nervousness by their domestic security expenditures. That's a trend that I think is I could point to a couple of other countries and make a similar sort of an observation. But back to your point, then, I'm wondering, in your view, to what lengths then does Chinese leadership go to keep the GDP growth story going? I mean, will they go to just what we might look in and say these are absurd lengths? Or at some point, does reality just overwhelm those efforts, and despite their best efforts, you have your market clearing event? How do you see this?
I see that the Chinese leaders are going to have to relent. They have said in the last couple months that they're not going to let go of their monetary tightening and their other administrative measures to cool the economy. But they've got to. The problem for them is that they don't have the same flexibility today that they had in 2008, 2009, when they went on the world's biggest spend-a-thon. Right now, they've still got inflation, which is a problem for them, and they've got the buildup of questionable loans in the banking system, and that limits their flexibility as to how much stimulus that they can dump into this economy this time. I mean, they've already built their ghost cities. I mean, what are they going to do? Are they going to build more of them? Well, yeah, they might, but that's going to be a real problem because they're now facing some real hard constraints. The Chinese leaders say that inflation has come down in October. They're talking 5.5% CPI growth in October, year on year. It's probably double that. The real issue, though, is food inflation. Mm-hmm. They're talking about 11 or so percent food inflation year on year, but it's probably, again, double that. Food inflation in the United States, not a big deal. You know, Americans spend, what, 9% of their disposable income on food. The poor in China spend somewhere between 45 to 48, maybe 50% of their disposable income on food. So when you're talking food inflation, even of 11%, which is the official number, that's a problem. But when you're talking about 25%, which is what it may actually be, that's a disaster for China's leaders. And that's why they can't really just do what they do now, what they did before, because they know that they're going to reignite inflation. And that's a problem for them that really poses a hard constraint. Yes, they will try to spend their way out of it. That's been their default position. But right now, they've got some real hard constraints on that tactic.
What if they try this tactic, though? What if they allow their currency to really rise in value? That would certainly quell the food inflation. It would mean that their oil import costs would go down on a yuan basis. Does that solve anything, or does that just put such a bullet in their export markets that it creates a larger set of problems on that side?
Well, it does both of what you say. It certainly will have real devastating effects on the export market, which is already in trouble, largely because of a fall off in European demand. But, you know, when they do something like that, they have got to make a political decision to do something that they weren't willing to do. Chinese leaders, and I think we need to back up and take a look at really the way the political system works, because the political system is very important for China. Mao Zedong said, you must put politics in command, and Chinese leaders have always put politics first. So take a look at what happened in the, about 5 years ago. Chinese leaders, at reacting to pressure from the United States and from elsewhere, said, yes, we want to increase domestic consumption. We want to be more flexible on our currency. They made a few measures towards those ends, but they didn't really do very much. They didn't do it at a time when the Chinese economy was really booming, when they didn't have a political transition. In other words, it was a sweet spot for them. They didn't do it then, but they're not going to do it now, which is you got a collapsing export sector, you got real troubles in the rest of the economy, and you have this political transition that is upcoming. So essentially, this is the worst possible time for them to do that. They have a growth model which is inappropriate for current global conditions. Their growth model is heavily dependent on exports, and when exports falter, they have a model which calls for increasing state investment. And that's why they were able to get through 2008 because of state investment. But right now, you know, that's not going to be very easy for them to make the adjustments, because if they want more domestic consumption, we've got to remember China has the lowest rate of contribution of domestic consumption to GDP in the world. It's like under 34%. If they're going to do something about that, it's not just a question of making a few changes. They've got to change their entire growth model. And to do that, that means that they've got to allow their currency to float, which you talked about. But it also means that they've got to allow state banks to offer market rates of interest to depositors, which means that they've got to allow the state banks to charge market rates of interest to state enterprises. They've got to allow workers to bargain collectively so they can get higher wages. They got to offer a better social safety net, especially in the healthcare area. These are very difficult things for any society to do. Certainly, they're very difficult in a political transition. And right now, that's where Chinese leaders are. They're not going to make these decisions. And unfortunately, they're going to just sort of ride this thing down.
You know, it's an amazing convergence of events you're talking about with the slowing economy on the one hand. We've got the political transition on another. And then I've got a third one here. So assume for the moment that world resources, especially energy, oil in particular, are getting scarce. Are you of the view that China might be late to this development party? That is, I see, you know, they had a strategy of rapidly westernizing with respect to both the built environment and transportation modes. You know, was that the wrong strategy? Are they coming late to this party? That is, will the resources be there, assuming they get past these current difficulties? Are the resources really there for them to continue on the path they're on? And if not, what is the plan here?
If you look out, let's say maybe 30, 40 years, there is a real resource issue because the world just can't support, 9% growth forever on the part of the Chinese economy. But I don't think we're going to get there. I think that they're going to run into the wall much earlier than that. So the assumption that you're talking about, I think we just really can't make. They may be able to get through this, but I think that it's pretty unlikely because, as you say, they've got a perfect storm. There's a convergence of really a lot of bad trends. They had a convergence of a lot of really good trends during their reform era, the period since 1978. And part of it is, Deng Xiaoping's policy of reform and opening up. The second decade of his policy coincided with the end of the Cold War, which meant the end to the political barriers to trade, which meant that globalization kicked into high gear, which means that China could sell. And China sold its way out of the Asian financial crisis at the end of the 1990s. They just exported their way out of problems. They can't do that right now because European consumers aren't taking Chinese exports the way they used to. And, the Americans, who I believe are still the global engine of the world economy, we'll buy stuff from China, but we're not going to buy it with double-digit increases like in the past. And that's really the problem for China, that its export sector is really in hard times. They have restrictions now, real hard constraints on state investment, and domestic consumption takes a decade to change, and even under the right circumstances, and they've got all the wrong circumstances. So I don't see any of the three legs of the Chinese economy being able to rescue things.
Interesting. I have one final sort of area to get your comments on here, and that's around how gold and gold ownership is viewed potentially as a store of wealth. I've read a lot of stories recently about how gold ownership got opened up, and there's very active trading and accumulation of physical bullion. There's a new exchange that's been opened up in Hong Kong. Are you familiar with what's going on there? And privately, what are your views on how the average Chinese wealthy person views gold ownership as a store of wealth?
The Chinese, for hundreds of years, have viewed gold as the store of wealth. And so if there's any hope for the gold market, it's going to be the Chinese. And I think the worse things that are in China, probably the better things are going to be for Chinese purchases of gold. So that is perhaps a floor for the gold market. We've had this enormous run-up in prices. I think the Chinese can really support that because I could see them switching to gold as a hedge for the problems in their own economy. It's, they're putting their wives and kids offshore. If they're willing to do that, it's probably not too much of a stretch to think that they're going to be buying all sorts of gold coins and trinkets and necklaces and all the rest of it.
Sure. The historical precedence of gold ownership as a store of value is there. Plus, they've also seen the ravages of currency inflation several times within living memory. So maybe even potentially now. So I think that there's certainly historical reason to want to safely sidestep your way into a hard asset as it could. I was really interested, though, in seeing how there seems to be a much more open atmosphere towards gold trading, gold exchanges, the flows of gold. It seemed like there had been a relaxing there. Was that an official relaxing or on purpose? Is that a strategic move to allow more gold to flow into rather than out of China?
Yeah, it was strategic. I mean, it was the government doing this. And it's very few things happen in China that the government doesn't approve of. What the one thing that's very interesting, though, is that the government will react. We will see, people actually reform on their own and then the government ratifying what they're doing. And I think that that's been part of what this is. But China has Beijing has really tried to create a modern financial system. And so, therefore, we've seen all sorts of reforms in stock markets and bonds and stuff like that. Well, gold is just another example of Beijing trying to replicate modern financial markets in China.
Excellent. Well, Gordon, you've given us a lot to think about, and I really appreciate your views here today. If people want to follow you and read your writings as you see this story unfolding, what's the best way for them to do that?
I devote my Forbes columns to the China economic story at Forbes.com. My website is Gordon Chang, GordonChang.com. I archive my articles there. I have Twitter at Gordon G. Chang, so you can find me there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
All right. Bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.